Welcome to episode 30 of the Hellbound podcast. This is an interview that's pre-recorded with Nicholas Vince, who played the Chatterer in Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2. He was also Kinski in Nightbreed, and he's a very close friend of the amazing Clive Barker, and we had a great time with this interview, and please enjoy. Welcome to the Hellbound interviews, firstly, Nicholas, and it's
thank you, Alex.
An absolute pleasure, and what's the significance and what are you using your green screen for at the moment?
It's for my new YouTube show, which is just launched at the beginning, 8th of October, called The Chattering Hour. And we started with Malcolm McDowell.
I saw something about that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. We had Malcolm McDowell and who else is Nancy Loomis. Nancy Loomis, who Annie Brackett from Halloween, just editing her. Courtney Gaines, they both go live tomorrow. Really do need to get those done.
It's so much work, isn't it?
Particularly when you discover that Zoom decided to actually slightly desynchronize Courtney's. So that was, I lost yesterday to basically nudging things just very, very
I know. The thing I found is I record on a separate camera that I feed into my computer, and I was recording because I prefer the look of 24 frames. I was recording in 24, and then I realized this was at 25. So every time I had cutaways, I would use it as a way to sort myself out. And it was, for a 2-hour podcast, that's a real pain. Would you have to cut away every 15 seconds or something? So.
Yeah. No, most of the time I use the Zoom background as well. Actually, can I choose a virtual background? I might even have a virtual back. Oh, I can actually choose a virtual background. Is it going to work? There we are. That's the virtual background But the trouble is with the virtual background in Zoom, my ears disappear because I'm bald. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you so much for coming on board. It's really good timing for us as well, because we've got our live film festival event on Friday. And this is going to lead up to that. So it's really good timing for us. We've just interviewed Jeffrey Reddick, who created Final Destination.
Right.
He's a really top guy. And it's just fun to, like I know you must have a huge passion for horror, past the point of, featuring in many of these films. So.
Sure. Yeah.
So how did your kind of love for horror, how did that start? Was it because of work? Was it because of you loved it when you were young?
No, it was back in the days, and we're talking about the 1970s when they used to show the Roger Corman, Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe films on Friday nights. Those were my gateway drugs into horror. Was the Vincent Price, Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe things, and definitely just what kicked off. And I think there was that, and then there was the Aurora model kits, glow in the dark monster filmland kits, which I discovered as well, that we had a local model shop, and they happened to have these things in. That must have been in the late 60s, early 70s, that those were available. So I had those things.
That's great. I was speaking to one of our judges for the festival, was Ramsey Campbell, who knew Clive back in the day, and they kind of know each other a little. I'm not sure if you know Clive, but Ramsey, sorry. Obviously, you know Clive. He was telling me how he started and sneaking into cinemas when he was much younger and kind of discovering horror that way. And it's really fascinating finding how people discover their passions and discover how they lean into their work. Like Joe Alves is another one of our judges. He's a production designer on Jaws, And he was saying when he had, it wasn't a club foot, it was something like a milder form of something like that. And he wanted to go dancing. He wanted to be a dancer originally. And he couldn't do that, obviously. And then he ended up drawing and becoming fascinated with architecture. So that's how he started. And then it led on to, you know, Close Encounters, Escape from New York. So it's really fascinating to see how people get into this. My gateway drug, so to speak, is, in a strange way, it's my elder brother, because when I was very young, it was Child's Play. It was the first couple of Hellraisers. It was Nightmare on Elm Street was a real bad one for me when I was like 6 or 7 years old. So it was, you know, it was sheer nightmares all the time because the visuals, as you know, are really strong. And especially 80s stuff. And that's what I've kind of gone back on myself. Instead of having nightmares, I kind of want to delve into that now. I don't want to kind of see nightmares. I just want to kind of be creative in that field, whether it's curating other people's films or kind of, you know, just enjoying new content. It's great. And thanks to you and, you know, the other chaps in the team and Clive, that's full of nightmares now. How did you kind of start in, because was Hellraiser your first feature?
Yes, Hellraiser was my first feature. I'd known Clive for a while. I've been doing a lot of modeling work for him. And it was, you know, he just said, Nick, would you like to be in a horror film? And I'm going, I'm newly out of drama school, or I've been out of drama school for a couple of years.
At that point, was he already painting, and did you know of his kind of passion for this kind of thing?
Oh yes, no, absolutely. I mean, Clive, I mean, long time before, as I say, I'd known Clive for about 3 years before we made Hellraiser. Clive had been painting since he was writing, which was, you know, since he could, I think, from my understanding, obviously a long time before I met him. So, and I'd seen his work. In fact, how I got to know him was by modeling for him for the covers of the Books of Blood, UK editions of the Books of Blood, the hardback editions, because Sphere published the paperbacks first, and then Clive did the covers for the hardback editions, and I modeled for those. So that's kind of how I got to know him, basically. And then he just said, you know, do you want to be in a horror film? I said, yes.
At what point, I've asked a couple of other filmmakers this and actors, at what point did you realize the significance of not necessarily the Cenobites, but the cultural impact it had, but people's passions for drawing the Chatterer and the other Cenobites? When did that kind of really go, oh my God, this is so kind of not necessarily cult, it's beyond a cult film though, I think. It's a cornerstone of horror, I think, now.
I think it was because, I suppose, when the film came out, it didn't have a big West End premiere or anything, it just went straight into, Doug Bradley, as Pinhead, made the front cover of Time Out magazine in London. And there was big spreads in that, and it was all over Fangoria magazine. I was aware of Fangoria because some of the guys had shown me that copies of it when we were making Hellraiser. And obviously this was the go-to magazine. But then it was 10 years after it was the 10th anniversary of the release of Hellraiser. I was invited to the States for the first time. And that's when this is big in America. But come to think of it, the first Pinhead tattoo I'd seen was when we did Hellbound. It was at a special screening for Hellbound. Because I remember Clive being there and this guy showing it. He had a Pinhead gun up here, so that it's going to be 88, something like that. And I remember, oh, wow, that's extraordinary. And it's Pinhead. I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I can't remember the first time I saw a Chatterer tattoo. But again, it was just kind of like, wow, that is extraordinary. And then obviously I have to say that that is a big shout out to Nigel Booth and Clive, the guys who actually designed and created the makeups. I just had to stand there and chatter my teeth. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's a real homage to their work, particularly.
There's something so strong about 80s horror icons. There's so few and far between a truly kind of iconic there is a few new stories that are like few new horror films, but there's so much now. There's so much kind of content. I go back to the 80s in many ways.
Yes, Because we had Freddy. It was Friday the 13th. Those big Michael Myers.
I think Myers was what, 79, 78?
79. I was just going to say, yes, I should know this because I just interviewed these interviews. I should know that date off the top of my head. When you think of the sequels and so on throughout the 80s as well. There were some extraordinary things going on in the 1980s in terms of horror.
How long did you work on the first one compared to the second? Because obviously the setup for the first is much more confined in terms of the loft space and outside the house is the ward, obviously.
That's interesting, of course, because you're asking an actor. So, of course, I was only ever called in for when they needed me.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think I probably did more days on the first film than, in fact, I'm pretty certain I did on the first film than I did on the second, because there was less for me to do on the second one. Because they expanded and it was more Pinhead's story, the second one. I do not know the number of days. I have 8 filming days in my mind as being a ballpark for the first film. Mm-hmm. And I think it was probably around about half a dozen on the second film.
Did the kind of experience of the makeup and the kind of heavy prosthetics, did that kind of build a bond between you as a group?
Yeah, absolutely. I made really good friends with Jeff Portis and Roy Puddiford, Little John Cormacan from Image Animation. I spend a lot of time obviously hanging out with those guys at the studios of Image Animation before cameras rolled. Because, you know, I went in for live casts and I probably did about 2 or 3 days. I made about 2 or 3 visits to the studios. Mm-hmm. And then over the course of the 3 films of Hellraiser, Hellbound and Nightbreed, I got to hang out with them an awful lot.
That's pretty cool. And it's, what do you think of its impact now? Because for me, Nightbreed has kind of elevated since the director's cut. The reconstructed cut, and there's an intro for it. Just to hop onto that for a sec, what did you think of the, not extended version, but you could call it a director's cut. That's how it's branded. What did you think of that?
The director, okay, so let's just clarify. There are 3 different versions that I know about. There's the original theatrical cut. There's the Cabal cut, which was put together by Russell Cherrington and others. And then there was the director's cut. I like the director's cut probably more because I got more, I'm in it more.
That must have been nice though.
I think for Clive, for Clive more than anything else. And funnily enough, somebody just messaged me this morning via Facebook. You're obviously familiar with Save the Cat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just published an article of the beat sheet for the director's cut based on Save the Cat. I was reading through that this morning. So I think there are different things to be said for each of those things. We wouldn't have the director's cut if it weren't for the Cabal cut, because Absolutely. It was, you know, that huge thing of the Occupy Midian and all the signatures that actually led to the footage being found that would allow us to actually having the director's cut. And obviously none of it would have been there without the theatrical cut to begin with. Yeah. And that wouldn't have been there without Clive putting pen to paper and writing Cabal, the novella on which it's all based anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is quite fascinating to me how these things kind of ripple on.
What was that? What was it like having... obviously, you went through the process of the prosthetics again. Mm. What was how many years difference was it between the two films?
Should know. So Halloween, so bad on dates. In fact, I'm just going to love this camera just slightly, so I'm not looking up. There we are. That I suddenly realized I'm looking up at you. So we did IMDb question. Filmed in 86, released in 87. Hellbound was the following year, and then it was 2 years after that, Nightbreed.
So was it very similar? Was it very similar kind of prosthetics? Well, obviously, it was a simpler design, Nightbreed.
So basically, it was the same crew for both image animation. It was an expanded crew for a Nightbreed. Yeah. So the guys who did Chatterer in Hellraiser, Nigel Booth. Chatterer in Hellbound, Cliff Wallace. He did the redesign with the eyes in as well. Neil Gorton from Millennium FX, Doctor Who, etc. Designed and created Kinski, and I believe Mark Coulier, Oscar winner, was the makeup assistant when I was in the chair for Nightbreed. And it was the same cinematographer on and sound guides. I mean, Clive took, you know, most of the crew worked on all three films. In terms of the makeup itself, it was a lot longer to put on Kinski than it was Chatterer, because
really?
Yeah, because Chatterer was just a single mask with a slit up the back that kind of went over like a balaclava.
Yeah.
Teeth went in, mask on. Kinski, I think, was only seven pieces, maybe, right, but it was still 5 hours of makeup. Whereas Chatterer was only an hour.
That's a huge difference, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So that was a quite. So basically, I got to learn. You know, I learned what Doug and Barbie and so on have been through on the first. You know, those 3 o'clock in the morning. So we were. The car was at 3 o'clock in the morning, makeup chair at 4 o'clock, on set at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Having said all that, of course, the guys I just had to sit in the chair whilst they applied the makeup to me. The guys who were actually on their feet, making sure I looked great, were Neil and Mark.
Because they're beautifully, like, there's the scene in towards the end of Hellbound, where Doe's character stands up as a defender, effectively, and it's such a beautifully lit scene. And was it it's kind of a marvel to look at, because that particular scene, there's something about how it's lit that's you don't hardly ever see as dynamic as certain scenes in those films. And I'll tell you a little strange story. My when we were having this house done, there were rooms upstairs that were bin bags in the windows, and the walls had been torn out. I was like, yeah, this looks like Frank's room upstairs. And then at night, because there's no lights in the room, I was like, yeah, I'm not going in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is the this is all Robin Vidgen, the lighting cameraman. My favorite moment is from the first movie. It's when Julia brings the first victim home.
See the glasses.
During the first.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think it's the businessman with the glasses, I think.
Does he have glasses? No, he doesn't have glasses.
Maybe that's
glasses
the second
is
one, yeah.
Third one.
Right.
It's the first one. And basically, it's so beautifully set up. You've got this kind of stained glass window in the background. And then literally Julia is hesitating on the threshold between light and dark.
Yeah.
The hallway in front of her is darkness. There's light behind her. Mm-hmm. But it's so beautifully lit. You're not really, unless you look at her, you realize that is literally what she's doing. She's hesitating on the threshold between light and darkness as she makes the decision as to whether or not she's actually going to go through with this. And, you know, that is obviously down to Clive and Robin Vidgen, really taught Clive everything.
Considering that was your first feature, and working with Cronenberg on Nightbreed as well, you know, in terms of on set, you must have been like a sponge for what was going on set, or at least have some sort of take something really kind of positive from it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, because the great joke is, of course, that when I was in the Chatterer makeup, I could hardly hear, speak or see. So I had no idea what was going on around me on a set. In fact, when I got to do Nightbreed, that's when I really learned how movies were made, because I could see, because Kinski has a lens. But up until that point, I really, you know, I had no real, I mean, I knew how the makeup stuff was done, knew all the atmosphere in the back. And of course, when we were doing Hellraiser, it was a tiny, tiny studio that we were filming in. So there was no, you know, there was no where you could go and watch things being filmed without being in the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it wasn't until... And then again, you know, you're always discouraged from going on set unless you've got a bloody good reason to be there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we filmed Hellbound at Pinewood and Nightbreed at Pinewood. But I was literally just being called down and being able to watch what was going on around me on the third, on Nightbreed, was really when I learned how movies were made.
So were you... Was Clive going through blocking the scenes to give you direction because you were limited in terms of what you could see or couldn't hear?
It's very interesting because, as I say, I could hardly hear, speak or see. I think, you know, we're talking about Simon Bamford who plays Butterball, was a very similar situation. They didn't really realise how little we could hear.
I see.
So I think when they first got us on set, it was like, I have no idea what's going on. And I'm not responding because I can't hear what's going on. And then they realized what they had to do was bring us onto set, explain to us what it is they wanted to do, show where the marks were. We agreed. I mean, basically, they used to, for the Chatterer, they used to put sandbags on the floor so that as I was walking forward, then I could feel with my feet when I had to stop, because that's obviously, I had no clue what was going on otherwise. So it was all those technical, you know, it was all those practical things that they did to help us and just make sure that we were able to do what they wanted us to do, basically.
I love it's almost an independent kind of idea, putting the sandbags down on the ground. It's such a simple idea, but it's brilliant as well. I love that.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I remember, what I do remember is that first shot of Chashra coming through the wall when he makes his first appearance. He looks as if he's walking forward on us, but in fact he's not. I was actually walking down a ramp, and they'd, because of the way the camera was positioned and the way I had to dolly it backwards, and it was such a small space, that okay, well, what we needed him is, we need him 6 inches higher at the start of the shot and on the floor at the end of the shot for when we do the reverse. And I just remember this being discussed. And then the next thing I knew, half an hour later, you just heard the sawing of wood and the hammering of nails. And there's a ramp for me to walk down, immediately, because you've got carpenters on set,
yeah,
or chippers on set to do all these things for you.
Since that point, have you kind of always kind of loved horror? Is it something that's continued? Because I've noticed some of your highlights, and I love the idea of that short. Let me find the name of your short film you had. Is it The Night Whispered? Is that available to watch anywhere online?
Do you know, I'm going to have to double check, because I can't remember if I've left it up on my website or not.
We'd love to be able to share that with people, you see.
NicholasVince.com. News content. Stores. No, they're not available just at the moment, but I'm sure we can sort it. Yeah, they have been. Actually, no, it is. I think it's called Real House. Night Whispered is available to watch online. The others are waiting. Okay. Or either releases or Real House, The Night Whispers is available on Real House.
What was that like? Is that something
as a writer director? This was such a learning curve, and I did it because I'd been doing the previous incarnation of my YouTube show. This one's called The Chattering Hour, and I used to do the chattering with Nicholas Vince, and I was into back in that. Series, I was interviewing independent filmmakers, so I got to meet an awful lot of really, really great independent filmmakers, such as Katie Bonham, Liam Regan, and all sorts of people. And I thought, you know, having interviewed all these people, I really should give this a go. It was great. It was absolutely fascinating process. Because we filmed it fairly close to where I live, and it was just like, you know, and it was just, you know, as you say, it was pure, everyone's doing this for their CV. So I paid for the insurance and the transport and made sure nobody was out of pocket, and we made sure they were all fed and well looked after.
Yeah.
Because it was just a short film. So yeah, it was really fascinating process. It's a very different part of your brain that gets engaged when you're. I mean, in that case, I was writing and directing and acting in it, but that was only because I was cheap.
Were you doing all the kind of admin and contacting everyone, doing all of that as well?
I did have a producer. I did have a producer working out as well, but I, But of course, it's all hands together, and you know, you end up by doing an awful lot of stuff. We even got my dog in it, and I cast my niece in it. And as I say, the dog, my niece, everyone. And as it turned out, it was the coldest night of that year. We filmed it at the beginning of October. About a week and a half's time. 3 years ago when we filmed it, and it was kind of weather like this. It was like 50, you know, 10, 12 degrees. Yeah. And then on the night we filmed, it dropped to zero. It literally dropped. and it was just so cold. It was so cold. All I remember, I mean, all anyone remembers, I think, about that filming was just how very, very, very cold it was.
Well, that's the thing is with independent filmmaking, or when you make short films, you've got to have that camaraderie. Everyone's got to be right. It's not just a payday. This is something I really want to be on the CV.
So
that can get you. Yeah. That can get you through some tough spots. Like I made this really very short. My first year in university film production, we made this short film in London now, and it required me walking into the sea at this temperature. So there's a really nice, beautiful wide shot, and it's graded really well. It's really, really nice, but it was the worst conditions. But when you've got that balls and you've got that drive to do something like that, I think it really can carry you home to finish it and to get over those hurdles. But you pay for it later.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did this? What made you kind of change the format of your kind of podcast and change the show?
Well, so basically I'd done 140 episodes of Chattering with Nicholas Events, and I wanted to concentrate on other things. Go back to concentrating on writing. And as you know, it takes a lot to put these things together.
A lot of time.
Yeah, and then that was it. I had no intention of doing it again. And then my manager, Chris Rowe, who's based in Los Angeles, at the beginning of lockdown, we were chatting over ideas, and he said, you know, be interesting thing to do. Would you be up for doing this again? And would you like to interview Malcolm McDowell?
Where do you start? Where did you, unless it's a little trade secret, unless you've not released the episode yet, where did you start? How did you start talking about him and his career? How did that?
Well, basically winding it, just going back to the very beginning, and starting with Clockwork and so on. The show's out. You can watch it.
We'll put a link in our description about that.
I think this is a great thing, is because I'm working with Chris, that we're choosing people he knows. I'm working very closely with Chris, who's my producer on this, basically.
I think that'll have a snowball effect as well, in terms of who you interview going forward.
Yes, absolutely. So basically, whereas the previous show was very much on the lines of speaking to independent filmmakers, you know, and when I set up the Chatting with Nicholas Events, it was very much, I'm always very conscious of the fact just how lucky I was that Clive chose me to be in his film. And I kind of wanted to pay it forward. And I thought, well, this is something kind of interesting to do. You know, this might be fun, something fun to do. And I will possibly be able to talk with some very interesting people, and we can have some very interesting conversations about filmmaking, kind of different generations talking.
Absolutely,
to each
yeah.
other. And then with this one, it's very much, you know, we're concentrating on people who've kind of the other end of the spectrum, who've been around for a long time. And so again, I'm finding it really interesting because, again, it's kind of similar but different, because obviously I'm talking to my peers about working in the business, although they've had much bigger careers than me, because I took a long time out to go and work in computers. But they, you know, Malcolm McDowell, Nancy Loomis, Courtney Gaines, is another one which is coming out on tomorrow, Thursday. It's Thursday, Los Angeles time, and I'm editing Courtney's interview this evening. That was a fascinating, because his career has been, you know, I'm talking to people who've had careers for 40 years in Hollywood.
Yeah,
mine's nothing like that, but you know, it's really, we're still just actors having a chat, really, about what it is to do the job of acting. But also, they've all got different, you know, you've all got different experiences as to, and you've worked with different directors, and you, there are different things that you learn from each one of them. So I'm absolutely loving it because I'm learning so much about the craft of acting.
Like what you said about the sandbags, it might seem like such a simple thing. Mm. People that are huge fans of Hellraiser and what we're doing at this festival, they'll absolutely love that little gem. And that's the kind of thing I love to hear. When I spoke to Joe Alves about being John Carpenter's production designer on Escape from New York, I asked him, whose idea was it? Isaac Hayes is driving around in one of these kind of limousine for trying to find Kurt Russell. And he's got chandeliers that like kind of got this kind of swan arm on the front of the car. And they're like headlights, but they're proper chandeliers. I'm like, when you watch the film, it's crazy, but it's in keeping with Isaac Hayes' character. And I asked Joe, whose idea was that? Was it John's or yours? Oh, it was mine. And I said, well, how did you get to that point? And he said, well, initially it was going to be one of those kind of half dome ones inside the car. So you could see Isaac Hayes with a chandelier inside this limousine. I was like, that's crazy. But when the purchaser for his production department bought the wrong chandeliers, they're like, we can't take these back. We have to use them somewhere. So they stuck them on the front of the cars. I said, that must have been a bit of a nightmare. I said, it was, because we had to buy dozens more because they kept breaking every time we did a stunt. But no, these little gems, this is what I love. I've loved interviewing filmmakers about, and with Alex Proyas, asked him about the rain machines in The Crow. It's just little things like that that kind of help to inspire and engage mm-hmm. filmmakers. That's why I started this festival. So I love the idea of your podcast, and I will absolutely be recommending it to our much. Filmmakers, and we'll put links in when we can as well. Are you doing much on Instagram for that podcast, or is it just kind of...
Yes, if you find the Chattering Hour, as I say, this show is being produced by Chris Rowe Management and Tea Time Productions. So, whereas when I did Chattering with Nicholas Vince, it was me and then my husband Craig during the show handling all the live questions. These are all pre-recorded shows. But I've got a production team of three supporting me on this. So we have a lovely lady called Amanda who's handling all the social media stuff because I don't have time because I'm doing all the editing. And
time-consuming. It's unreal. Yeah. Like, yeah. I love like when I put... post out about your interview or Jeffrey Reddick's or a couple of other filmmakers I've got lined up. It's really nice, the idea of social media, but as soon as you delve into it, you realize how much is involved, and even just editing, it's straightforward, it's so complex. But there was something I wanted to ask you about your, is it a stage, like a monster stage play?
Yes. So at the end of last year, and so this, so if I hadn't been doing this, this is what I would have been doing. So at the end of last year, I decided to do a one-man show all about my experiences about making Hellraiser, how I got into making films, how I got, you know, more behind the stories on making Hellbound, Nightbreed. But also, what is it to be a monster? Why do I consider myself a monster? Why have I been made to feel a monster? So it was an hour-long show, which I did for the London Horror Festival last year, called I Am Monsters. We did it for three nights. And the reason that I was doing it there was because I've been the patron of the London Horror Festival for the last 4 years or so, and the London Horror Festival is the UK's oldest and longest running festival of live horror performance, so that's another thing I've been delighted to have been part of. So I was up at the Pleasance Theatre in London, did that for three nights, and the plan was that this year I was going to be taking it out on tour.
Yeah, that's not going to happen this year. An online version of that, or adapting it some way, could be quite interesting.
Yeah, I really want to. It's the thing is with one man shows, you really want to do it in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
You know, what I had always said that I wanted to do a film version of it. But ideally, what I wanted to do was to film three nights with different audiences and with cameras in slightly different positions. Yeah. So that you could get three, you know, you get three bites of the run.
Absolutely, that's what.
A live performance.
Yeah. That's when when you hear about stand-up comedians, when they do a recording for, say, Netflix or whoever it's for, they can almost manipulate the energy into what you want in the final version as well.
Because
you might have moments that are truly, oh, that's fantastic how that went. But the second night's not as good, but there's a moment in that second night that is great.
I think it's definitely still
possible to do that. But obviously the audience, that's not going to be there. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I don't think that's, you know, and as I say, and the original idea was I wanted to take it out. You know, my original idea was I'd take it into fringe theatres in the country. Yeah. Sadly, I don't know how many of those are going to be surviving next year.
I know, it's extremely scary to think about, outside of your own circumstances, how businesses have just been turned completely upside down. Like the closest thing to, if I'm honest, to religion for me is going to the cinema, you know, in terms of the moments you have, the stories that are being told, being scared shitless and having a laugh. And it's really kind of terrifying for people's just livelihoods just disappearing overnight.
And for this
kind of industry, it's the film industry, it's extremely difficult. And hopefully we'll see green shoots coming out of it in terms of different approaches. I think there'd be a lot of positivity coming out of it as well.
Yes. Yeah. No, I touch wood. I mean, we can always rely on human ingenuity to come up with things and so on. But it's going to be a different world, 2021. Whatever happens, it's going to be a very different world, I think. Yeah. But, you know, I think people will adjust. People obviously want to be able to watch new material. So there,
absolutely, you know,
and those are people who are, you know, able to carry on working and have still got jobs. You know, they are keeping, you know, Amazon and Netflix are getting more subscribers than theirs. You know, so in theory, or in my theory,
there will be
more productions happening again at some point in the future, I'm sure.
I think these streaming companies have finally realized, it's like companies like Shudder and Arrow Video, they realized how big the audience is in terms of streaming content, and horror is so potent now. And with that, I wanted to ask you about how did it come to writing some stories for Marvel? How did that work?
So basically, this is going back. And so I should have said earlier on, just a quick time out. I can probably only give you about another 10 minutes or
so. That's absolutely fine, Nicholas. That's fine.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, to answer that question about comics. So this was basically happened during Nightbreed. There was a scene that is in the director's cut where Anne Bobby, who plays Laurie, is singing in a nightclub. And Clive basically got all his mates, because obviously Clive was a huge comic reader. And they were talking about doing the Hellraiser comics during the filming of Nightbreed. And I used money from Nightbreed to go to visit the States. And I just pitched up at Marvel offices, had the name of the the editor. I just waltzed in and said hi. I'd like to talk to them. Didn't have any point or anything.
Yeah.
And he just bought the thing, and then that led to working with Marvel UK, working with Epic Comics, because Hellraiser was an Epic comic, which is part of Marvel. So it was great. I spent 3 years writing comics and had a great deal of fun. And again, met some really talented artists such as John Bolton during that time.
We've got an artist that worked with Ramsey Campbell on a couple of his covers called Dave Kendall, and he's been working on Judge Death stuff for 2008 at the moment.
Oh wow!
And he's judging. He's one of our festival judges, and I spoke to him a few weeks ago about the festival and what he needs to do, and he's the nicest guy in the world. But when you look at his material, it's the darkest stuff. It's really sinister. And would you say that of your experience of working with filmmakers and other actors, that the ones that kind of gravitate towards horror, are they kind of light as air in many ways, but they have kind of dark thoughts and they focus that?
Yeah, I think basically we get it out of our system.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you a little question. This is for something next year, if you're interested. Mm-hmm. In being a cosplay judge for our festival next year, and all they require is just picking some of your favorites, because we've had some outstanding cosplays that are next level. They look like movie level. That's how good they are.
I would be delighted. I'd be delighted to do that. That sounds a great deal of fun. Yes,
and it would be kind of a perfect thing for you to get from. Yeah. So what I'll do is in a few months' time, or I'll kind of just kind of keep touch base with you every so often about when our interview's going out. And then I'll put you in touch with Michael Chan, who's our community content producer. There's only three of us, but we've kind of done so much. But I think Michael will be delighted that you could be a judge on that. And Alex Proyas is going to be our festival judge again next year, which is great. So, thank you very much, Nicholas. This has been a real treat for me.
Good. All right.
Good luck with the podcast. I really look forward to watching that.
All right, then. And if you, whilst we've still got the chat up, let me type up. So, rather than sending people to the website, let me send you to, the Chattering Hour is, as I say, is produced by Chris Rowe Management. Okay. So you have to go to the Chris Rowe Management YouTube channel.
Okay.
I'm just opening up my wonderful Trello where I've actually got the links. Because actually, occasionally, I haven't got my glasses on. Notes, bit.ly links, there we are. CRN YouTube, that's what we want.
I would have asked Malcolm McDowell about Star Trek, but it's called a big Trekkie.
Yeah.
Because he was outstanding in that film.
We ran out of time anyway. I should have said that the Chattering Hour is also it's both YouTube and it's a podcast as well. Fantastic. So it's on Apple Podcasts as well. But those are bit.ly links.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's great.
So you can just share those. Those will get people to the...
Excellent. So thank you very much, Nicholas. Real pleasure. And I'll keep in touch with you about next year. And you won't get spammed with email. It'll just be like once every so often. But what I'll actually do is send you five or six of our best, because there's a lady in Brazil, I think it's Brazil or Argentina, who's the pinhead. And it's unreal, the pictures she's done. So it'll going to give you a taste of what we've got next year.
Right. Oh, people are amazing. They are absolutely amazing. All right, then, sir. I need to run.
Have a good day, mate.
Take care, sir.
See you.
Bye.